The time now? 8:30. Saturday Night Theatre.
Mutiny on the Bounty. Dramatized for radio by Robert Cushman from the novel by Charles Nordoff and James Norman Hall. With Geoffrey Matthews, Martin Jarvis, and Geoffrey Beavers. Mutiny on the Bounty.
Roger Byam, former midshipman on board His Majesty's ship, Bounty. In the autumn of the year 1787, I journeyed to London from my home in Devon to pay my respects to Sir Joseph Banks, President of the Royal Society, companion of the immortal Captain Cook, and explorer of the great South Sea. Sir Joseph had been a great friend of my father, and indeed, since his death, had almost stood in place of a father to me. For this reason, I had expected dinner to be the occasion of a leisurely tête-à-tête between us, but to my surprise, Sir Joseph had another guest.
Lieutenant William Bligh, Roger.
I see, sir.
He was Captain Cook's first lieutenant on his last voyage.
Oh, Lieutenant Bligh.
How do you do, young man?
Sir Joseph, it's an honour.
I thought you'd be pleased. A glass of wine, Roger.
Thank you.
Young Roger Byam, son of Byam the astronomer.
Great loss. He was known by name, at least, to all who practiced navigation.
I know that he thought very highly of you, sir.
I'm honored that he should have known of me.
He, too, had a consuming interest in all that pertained to the South Sea.
Aye.
Is it true, sir, that the Indians of Tahiti are as happy as Captain Cook believed?
Ah, young man, happiness is a vast word. It's true that they live without great labor and that nearly all the light tasks they perform are self-imposed. Released from the fear of want and from all salutary discipline, they regard nothing seriously.
My father and I used to study the ideas of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He believes that happiness can only be enjoyed by man in a state of nature.
I have been told of his ideas, though unfortunately I left school too young to learn French. But if a rough seaman may express an opinion on a subject better suited to a philosopher, I believe that true happiness can only be enjoyed by a disciplined and enlightened people. As for the Indians of Tahiti, their conduct is regulated by 1,000 absurd restrictions which no civilized man would put up with for a moment. They make up a kind of unwritten law called taboo, laying down fanciful and unjust rules to control every action of a man's life. A few days among men in a state of nature might have changed Monsieur Rousseau's ideas. You know French, then, young man?
I'll do him justice, Mr. Bligh. Roger might pass for a native of France more easily. And he's making progress in German now.
I wish I had his gift. Lord, I'd rather face a hurricane than translate a page of Caesar nowadays. And the task you set me is worse still. May I tell him, Sir Joseph?
I see no harm.
I don't know if your father's scientific interests ever extended to botany, but you've heard, perhaps, of the breadfruit plants.
It flourishes in Tahiti.
And in Hawaii. Well, several of the West India merchants and planters have petitioned the Crown, asking that a vessel be fitted out suitably to convey the breadfruit from Tahiti to the West Indian Islands, a cheap and wholesome fruit for their Negro slaves. Sir Joseph here thought well of the idea and gave it his support. It is due largely to his interest that the Admiralty is now fitting out a small vessel for the voyage, and I am to be given command.
I see, sir. But why should such a commission make you apprehensive?
Oh, as to that part of it, I have no qualms. My ship, the Bounty, will be a floating garden, fitted with every convenience for the care of the plants. I have no fear but that we shall be able to carry out the purpose of the voyage. But Sir Joseph has a further commission for me.
I've solicited Lieutenant Bligh most earnestly to employ his time in Tahiti in acquiring a greater knowledge of the Indians and their customs, and a more complete vocabulary and grammar of their language than it has hitherto been possible to gather. I believe that a dictionary of the language in particular might prove of the greatest service to mariners in the South Sea.
Oh, that's all very well, but I know as little of dictionaries as of Greek, and I shall have no one on board qualified for such a task.
How shall you lay your course, sir, about Cape Horn?
I shall make the attempt. By your leave, Sir Joseph. Young man, how would you like to sail with me?
Do you mean it, sir? Would it be possible?
It rests with you to decide. It'd be a pleasure to make a place for you among my young gentlemen.
You've paid Roger a compliment. But could an inexperienced lad be of use to you on board?
He'll make a seaman, never fear. I've taken a fancy to the cut of his jib, as the old tars say. And I could put his gift for languages to good use.
How long shall you be gone?
2 years, perhaps.
He was to have gone up to Oxford, but I suppose that could wait. Well, sir, what do you say?
With your permission, there is nothing I would rather do.
Then you have it. I would be the last to stand in the way. A voyage to the South Sea.
Good morning, Sir Joseph.
Morning, Roger. I have something for you. My vocabulary of the Tahitian language, Roger. I've had this copy made. Short and imperfect, as you'll discover, but may prove of some service to you. Please observe that the system of spelling Captain Cook and I adopted should be changed.
Yes, sir.
Now, you will be some months in Tahiti while they're gathering the young breadfruit plants. Bligh will see to it that you're given leisure to devote yourself to the dictionary I hope to publish on your return. It will be in demand among mariners before many years have passed. At present, we think of the South Sea as little less remote than the moon, but depend upon it, the rich whale fisheries will soon attract notice now that we've lost the American colonies.
Sir Joseph?
Yes, my lad?
When you invited Mr. Bligh to dinner, did you anticipate that he would ask me to join him?
Yes, Roger, I did. I knew he had need of your abilities. But haven't you always wished to sail unknown seas?
Oh, yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, books you're always reading, books of travel. You must have them off by heart. Oh, I'm sure I've done the right thing. There are many distractions in Tahiti. Take care that you're not misled into wasting your time. And above all, take care in the selection of your Indian friends. When a ship drops anchor in Martify Bay, the Indians come out in throngs, each eager to choose a friend. A Tayo. Bide your time. Learn something of politics on shore and choose as your Tayo a man of consideration and authority. Such a man can be of infinite use to you. Should you choose a man of the lower orders, you may find him dull, incurious, and with an imperfect knowledge of the Indian tongue. In my opinion, they're not only a different class, but a different race.
You mean there's no more equality in Tahiti than amongst ourselves?
Or less, I should say. The Indians have a false appearance of equality from the simplicity of their manners and the fact that the employment of all classes is the same. But as for real equality, no action, however meritorious, can raise a man above the position to which he was born.
I see.
Do you know, the chiefs alone are thought to have souls. well now, you've everything you will need.
Yes.
Midshipman's fare is not the best in the world. When you go on board, one of the master's mates will ask you for £3 or £4 to lay in a few small luxuries for the berth. Have you a sextant?
Yes, sir, one of my father's. I showed it to Mr. Bligh.
I'm glad Bligh's in command. There's not a better seaman afloat. I'm told he's a bit of a tartar at sea, but better a taut hand than a slack one any day. He will instruct you in your duties. Perform them smartly. And remember, discipline's the thing.
Toward the end of November, I joined the Bounty at Spithead. It makes me smile today to think of the box I brought down on the coach from London, packed with clothing and uniforms on which I had laid out more than £100. For a few days, I made a brave show in my finery, but when the Bounty sailed, it was stowed away for good and worn no more. Our ship looked no bigger than a longboat among the tall first rates and 74s at anchor nearby. 90 feet long on deck, and with a beam of 24 feet, her burthen was little more than 200 tons. Her great cabin was now rigged as a garden, with innumerable pots standing in racks. The ship was small to begin with, and she carried a heavy cargo of stores and articles for barter with the Indians, which meant that all hands on board were so cramped that I heard mutterings even before we set sail. In fact, our ship looked more like a whaling vessel than an armed transport of His Majesty's Navy. All was new and strange to me on the morning when I presented myself to Lieutenant Bligh. I found him on the quarter-deck. A tall, swarthy man was just ahead of me.
I've been to the Portsmouth Observatory, sir. The timekeeper is 1 minute 52 seconds too fast for meantime. Mr. Bailey made a note of it in this letter to you.
Thank you, Mr. Christian.
Excuse me, sir.
Ah, Mr. Byam, this is Mr. Christian, the master's mate. He will show you your berth and instruct you in some of your duties. And by the way, this evening you will dine with me on board the Tigress. Captain Courtney knew your father and asked me to bring you when he heard that you would be on board. Be ready in an hour's time.
These are your quarters, Mr. Byam. Snug, you see.
Snug indeed, sir. How many of us to live in this kennel?
Count the birds. There'll be four of you, Mr. Stewart, Mr. Tinkler. I believe they're both ashore. This is Mr. Haywood. Mr. Haywood, Mr. Byam, our new midshipman.
Ah, good day. How old are you, Byam?
17.
17? And this is your first voyage?
Yes.
I'm 16 and I've been at sea 2 years. Please not to forget that.
Mr. Haywood knows you for a jolly newcomer. But such airs would be more fitting aboard a first-rate. Now, Lieutenant Bligh desires me to instruct you in some of your duties. Navigation, nautical astronomy, and trigonometry he will teach you himself. And I assure you, you will not sup till you have worked out the ship's position each day. You'll be assigned to one of the watches to keep order when the men are at the braces or aloft. You will see that the hammocks are stowed in the morning and report the men whose hammocks are badly lashed.
Yes, sir.
Follow me, Mr. Byam, would you? Never lounge against the guns or walk the deck with your hands in your pockets.
Sorry, sir.
And last of all, you are the slave of those tyrants, the master and master's mates.
Ah, Mr. Christian, there you are.
Mr. Fryer, the master.
What a madhouse. I'd like to sink the lot of those bumboat men and heave the wenches overboard. Who's this? A new reefer, Mr. Byam, I'll be buying.
Yes, sir.
Welcome on board, Mr. Byam. Your father's name stands big in our science, eh, Mr. Christian?
Indeed.
Madhouse. Thank God we shall pay off tomorrow night. Winches everywhere, above decks and below. Go forward, Mr. Christian. Gather a boat's crew. Lieutenant Bligh. A few men still sober.
Aye, aye, sir. You there?
There's discipline on a man of war at sea, Mr. Byam, but give me a merchant ship in port. The captain's clerk's the only sober man below. The surgeon, well, see for yourself.
Ahoy there, Mr. Fryer. Have you seen Nelson, the botanist? I prescribed a drop of brandy for his rheumatic leg. It's time he took his medicine.
He's gone ashore, Bacchus.
He'll give his good shillings to some Portsmouth quack, I'll wager. Yet here on board he might enjoy free and gracious the advice of the most enlightened medical opinion. Away with all bark and physic. Here is the remedy for 9/10 of human ills. Aye, drops of brandy, that's it. And Johnny shall have a new bonnet. And Johnny shall go to the fair. And Johnny shall have a blue ribbon.
What did you call him, Mr. Fryer? Backer.
Aye, boy. His name is Thomas Huggam, so it's inscribed in the ship's articles. I've never known him to be called by it. He's old Bacchus to all the ship's company, for obvious reasons. Though, compared with the rest of the crew at this moment, he's cold sober.
I'm surprised that Mr. Bligh allows it, sir. I heard he was a strict man of discipline.
Oh, he is. But he knows these men have a 2-year voyage ahead of them. For 2 days, they have the right to enjoy themselves.
Our boat's crew, if not strictly sober, were able to row and put their backs into it with a will. As we drew away from the Bounty, I gazed back up at her riggings, feeling something of the spell which even the smallest ship casts over me to this day. For a ship is the noblest of all man's works, a cunning fabric of wood and iron and hemp, wonderfully propelled by wings of canvas, and seeming at times to have the very breath of life. We were soon alongside Captain Courtney's tall 74, the Tigress.
A glass of sherry with you, Mr. Bligh.
Thank you, Captain.
To the memory of your father, young man.
Thank you, sir.
We seamen owe him a lasting debt. My apologies. They're flogging a man through the fleet when I hear the boat's coming. I must officiate at the gangway. A deuced bore. Make yourselves at home. Do you wish to be spectators? Of course. The poop deck, Bligh. You will have a splendid view.
Here comes, lad, the procession.
Oars! boat from every ship in the fleet. There's the longboat with the prisoner, bent over in the bows, sir.
Thank God. What's the matter, Mr. Byam? Haven't you seen blood before?
Blood, yes. But the man's back, there's no flesh left. The bones are bare.
Captain Courtney, sir. The man is dead.
Dead? Lucky devil. Bosun's mate,
sir.
Do your duty. 2 dozen, I believe. Come, do your duty.
Soup's cold. Hardships of a seaman's life, eh, Bly?
Damn it, we fared worse as midshipmen.
But not in Tahiti, I wager. I heard you were to pay the Indian ladies of the South Sea another call.
Aye, and a long one.
I heard of your voyage in town. I wish I were sailing with you. Are the Indian women as handsome as Cook painted them?
Indeed they are, if you've no prejudice against a brown skin. They have enough sensibility to attract a fastidious man. Witness Sir Joseph Banks. He declares there are no other such women in the world.
Say no more. Say no more. I can see you in the midst of a harem the Sultan himself might envy.
What had the man done, Captain Courtney?
Mm-hmm. Oh, the fellow who was flogged. Mm. Oh, he was one of Captain Allison's foretopmen on the Unconquerable. Tried to desert and blacked Allison's eye when he was discovered.
What?
Odd. We were only the 5th ship. 8 dozen did for him. Hmm. But Allison has a bosun's mate who's an artist. Left-handed. So he lays them on crisscross and strong as an ox.
Struck his captain, eh? My God, he deserved all he got and more. No laws are more just than those governing the conduct of men at sea.
Is there any need of such cruelty, sir?
What?
Why did they not hang the poor fellow and have done with it?
Poor fellow? Huh, you have much to learn, my lad. A year or two at sea will harden him. Eh, Bly?
I'll see to that. No, Mr. Byam, you must not waste any sympathy on rascals of that stripe.
Discipline must be preserved, and mutiny and piracy suppressed.
Our sea law is stern, but it has the authority of centuries.
Still agitated by the shock of what I had seen, I ate little and took more wine than was my custom, while the 2 officers gossiped as to the whereabouts of former friends. For nearly a month, the Bounty was detained by contrary winds. It was not until the 23rd of December that we set sail down the channel with a fair wind. It was still dark that morning when I heard the bosun's pipe and the call of Morrison, the bosun's mate.
All hands! Turn out and sail a crew! Out or down here, rise and shine! Out or down there!
Lash
and carry!
Hold short, Mr. Fryer, sir.
Thank you. Loose the topsails, Mr. Christian. Give the word.
Loose the topsails! Mr. Byam, to the mizzen top with you.
Aloft there! What are you doing? You're asleep for a top! The main topmen are up the yard! Look alive, you crawling caterpillars! Put it on your pool! Start burn! Start burn!
The sun rose in a cloudless sky, a glorious winter's morning. The Bounty headed away to sea, going like a racehorse with topgallants set. The men of the Bounty had been attracted by the prospect of a voyage to the South Sea, all selected for their stations by the master or Bligh himself. Our 14 able-bodied seamen were true salts, not the scum of the taverns and jails impressed to man so many of His Majesty's ships. The officers were nearly all men of experience and tried character, and even our botanist, Mr. Nelson, had been recommended by Sir Joseph Banks because he had previously sailed to Tahiti under Captain Cook. In all, the Bounty's company numbered 46. We carried no purser. Bligh filled the office himself, assisted by Samuel, his clerk, a smug, tight-lipped little man who was believed, not without reason, to be the captain's narker, or spy, among the men. He was heartily disliked by all hands. Again, not without reason, since the food on the Bounty was of poorer quality and issued in scanter quantities than any man of us had seen before.
Are you going to be all day breaking open those casks, Muspratt?
Mr. Samuel's right to be impatient, Muspratt. Van Den Day's tomorrow. Men want their cheese then, not next year.
Just finishing, sir. That's the last one.
Let me see. That's not a full cask.
What's that?
There are two cheeses missing from this cask, Captain Bligh. 50 pounds weight.
They've been stolen.
Perhaps you'll recollect, sir, while we were in Deptford, the cask was opened by a order and the cheeses was carried ashore.
You insolent scoundrel, you hold your tongue.
What's the matter, sir?
Ah, Mr. Christian, Mr. Friar. Damn set of thieves, but I'll tame you, by God, I will. Another word from you, Muspratt. I'll have you seized up and flogged to the bone. Mr. Samuel.
Sir?
See that the cheese allowance is stopped. From the officers, too, mind you. Until the deficiency is made good.
Mr. Friar.
Sir?
I have another matter to raise with you. You will continue to take the first watch. The gunner will take the second.
And the third, sir?
Mr. Christian. Acting Lieutenant Christian.
Sir?
Yes, Mr. Friar. I'm promoting him. Oh, come, Mr. Friar. Mr. Christian is a rising young man and a gentleman born, as he will not be the last to inform you. We old sailors must not stand in his way. Take it with a good grace, Mr. Friar.
So, the captain gains a lieutenant, and I lose a subordinate. Congratulations, Mr. Christian.
I assure you, Friar, I knew nothing of this. This whole comedy was played without my knowledge.
But to your advantage...
I carried those two cheeses to Mr. Bligh's house with a cask of vinegar and some other things. They were sent up in a boat from Longreach. I'll swear to it.
Perhaps you would, Millwood, but I advise you not to. Not within Mr. Samuel's hearing. Now, carry on now.
Aye, aye, sir.
Well, Mr. Byam, you see there is more to life at sea than you ever found in your father's library.
Captain Bligh seems a very harsh man, sir.
A gentleman born. God help me for an arrant snob, Mr. Byam. But such an officer would never have concerned himself with cheeses.
Not even to make a profit from them.
Oh, that happens all the time. The captain is not so well paid, you know. They all fill their pockets if they can. But I confess they are not all so blatant about it. You heard Millward just then? British seamen can put up with a harsh captain, but nothing will drive them to mutiny faster than one who lines his pockets at their expense.
And he's reduced the bread allowance. It's down by a third.
Now, that was necessary. We lay so long at Spithead that we missed the season for sailing round Cape Horn. So, the voyage will be longer. Did you hear any grumbling about the bread?
No, sir.
You see, Mr. Byam, the men realize the justice, the necessity of it. They have no quarrel with Mr. Bligh over that. And you should have no quarrel with him either. He's instructing you in navigation. Do you not feel the advantage of it?
He's certainly an expert teacher.
More than that, Mr. Byam. There's no finer seaman and navigator afloat. And it's taken the Admiralty so many years to recognize the fact. Now, this voyage means a great deal to him. He cannot bear to contemplate any possibility of failure. Now I am his lieutenant. I must try to prevent him from ruining his great chance.
As the private stocks of provisions obtained in Spithead began to run out, all hands went from grub galore to the king's own, as seamen say. Our salt meat was unspeakably bad. And a more villainous cook than the midshipman's mess boy, young Tom Ellison, would be impossible to find.
Have a look at that, Mr. Byam. Mm. Straight from the cask. What'll it be, I wonder? Not beef or pork, that's certain. You seen a victualling yards in Portsmouth, sir?
No, never. But as Mr. Haywood will tell you, I'm a jolly newcomer. Now, Mr. Stewart here's an old salt. He must know the Portsmouth yards.
I've seen them, but I preferred to keep my distance.
Well, you'll bear me out, sir. Pass that way any night and you'll hear the dogs bark and the horses neigh. Oh. And I'll tell you something else you young gentlemen don't know. It's as much as a black man's life's worth to pass that way by night. They pop him into a cask like that.
On my word, Ellison, I think I believe you.
One sultry afternoon, Bligh sent his servant to bid me sup with him. I dressed myself with some care and found that Christian and Friar were my fellow guests. There was a fine show of plate on the captain's table, but when the dishes were uncovered, I saw that Bligh fared little better than his men.
Damn them. A lazy, incompetent pack of scoundrels. God knows the captain has trials enough without being cursed with such a crew. Dregs of the public houses. That fellow I flogged yesterday, what was his name, Mr. Fryer?
Burkitt.
Ah, Burkitt. Insolent hound. All as bad. Damn if they know a sheet from a tuck.
I venture to differ with you, sir.
I should call Smith, Millwood and McCoy first-class seamen. And even Burkitt, though he was in the wrong.
Insolent hound. Slightest report of misconduct, I shall have him seized up again. Next time it'll be 4 dozen, and so too.
If I may express an opinion, Mr. Bligh.
Yes.
Burkitt's nature is one to tame with kindness rather than with blows.
La-di-da, Mr. Christian. On my word, you should apply for a place as master in a young lady's seminary. Fine captain you'll make if you don't heave overboard such ridiculous notions. Kindness. The seamen understand kindness as well as they understand Greek. Fear is what they do understand. Without that, mutiny and piracy would be rife on the high seas.
Aye, there's something in that.
I cannot agree. Our seamen do not differ from other Englishmen. Some must be ruled by fear, it is true. But there are others, and finer men, who will follow a kind, just, and fearless officer to the death.
Oh, have we any such paragons on board?
In my opinion, sir, we have. And not a few.
Oh, now, by gosh, name one.
Mr. Purcell, the carpenter.
Damn, you're a fine judge of men, that stubborn, thick-headed rogue. Kindness, that's too good.
You won't have the carpenter, as he... Then may I suggest Morrison, sir?
Suggest to your heart's content. Morrison, the gentlemanly boatswain's mate, the sheep masquerading as a wolf. Kindness. Morrison's too damn kind now.
But a fine seaman, sir. He's been a midshipman. He's a gentleman born.
I know, I know. No higher in my estimation for all that. Saving your presence, Mr. Byron. Damn all midshipmen, I say. There can be no worse schools than the berth for the making of officers. As for Morrison, let him take care. I have my eye on him. He spares the cat. A boatswain's mate who was not a gentleman would have had half the hide off Burkitt's back. Let him take care, I say. Let him lay on when I give the word, or by God, I'll have him seized up for a lesson from the boatswain himself.
Mr. Bligh, sir.
What is it, Mr. Samuel?
The men will not eat the pumpkins, sir.
Will not eat them?
I think I've had some warning of this, Mr. Bligh. Mr. Samuel, these are the pumpkins you've issued to the men in lieu of bread?
Yes, Mr. Fryer. They were too big for the use of the captain's table.
But the rate of exchange, Mr. Samuel. 1 pound of pumpkin for 2 pounds of bread. Can you wonder that they're discontented?
Well, Mr.
Sir, they'll complain to you, Mr. Fryer. They're not content. Let me tell you, by God, they'd better make up their minds to be content. Everything that Mr. Samuel does is done to my orders. Do you understand? My orders. The men need waste no more time in complaints, so they get no more redress. I'm the only judge of what is right and wrong. Mr. Samuel.
Yes, sir?
Summon the first man of every mess. We'll see who will dare to refuse the pumpkins, insolent rascals. By God, I'll make them eat grass before I'm done with them.
Perceiving that no redress was to be hoped for, the men neither murmured nor complained from that time. But the officers, though they dared make no open complaints, were less easily satisfied and murmured frequently among themselves of their continual state of hunger, which they thought was due to the fact that the captain and his clerk had profited by the victualling of the ship. About 100 leagues off the coast of Brazil, the ship was becalmed for a day or two, and the people employed themselves in fishing for the sharks that swam about the ship. At least one of the fishermen was successful, Churchill, the master-at-arms. The men lost no time in getting the shark aboard. It was hardly dead before they had straddled it and had begun to hack it to pieces.
Never mind what you're about, Fear.
Take care, or she'll have a slice off your backside.
Move yourself, Burkitt. The head is mine, right of capture. Ah, Mr. Byam, have you tasted shark?
No. I don't know that I could stomach it.
Oh, you'll be all right, sir. Cut into slices like beefsteak. Parboiled and broiled with pepper and salt. Tastes like codfish. Better than Mr. Samuel's salt beef.
Talk of the devil, Church. It's a real shark.
Fine catch, my good man. I must have a slice.
So you must have a slice, must you? Well, I must have a glass of grog and a stiff one, too, if you're to eat shark today.
Come, my good man. You've enough fish there for a dozen.
And you've had enough grog stored away for 1,000, by God.
It's for the captain's table I want it.
Then catch him a shark yourself. This is mine. He gets the best of the bread and the pick of the junk cask as it is.
You forget yourself, Churchill. Come, give me a slice, that large one there, and I'll say nothing.
Say nothing, be damned. Here, take your slice. Ooh!
Flung the fish in his face, did he, Byam?
Knocked him right over.
Mind you, when Mr. Samuel picked himself up, he was careful to pick up his slice of shark as well.
It'll be no joke for Churchill, lad. The least he can hope for is a red-checked shirt at the gangway. Samuel's a worm and a dirty worm, but discipline's discipline, begad.
All hands fell in to witness punishment, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Christian. Are the gratings prepared, Mr. Purcell?
The gratings are rigged, sir.
Charles Churchill, step forward. Have you anything to say?
No, sir.
Strip. Seize him up. Very well, Mr. Morrison. 36. Do your duty. I'll show the man who's captain of this ship, Mr. Christian. By God, I will. Mr. Morrison, see that you lay on with a will.
On the 20th of August, 8 months out of England, having rounded the Cape of Good Hope, we anchored in Adventure Bay, Van Diemen's Land. We passed a fortnight there, wooding, watering, and sawing out planks of which the carpenter, Mr. Purcell, was in need. Mr. Bligh put me in charge of a watering party, instructing me to have the casks filled in a gully near to where Purcell had rigged his saw pit. One morning, Bligh appeared to...
discovered when I cut some of them down.
Useless nonsense, man. Mr. Nelson, am I not right?
I am a botanist, Mr. Bligh. I make no pretense to a carpenter's knowledge of wood.
Ah, that's what a carpenter does know. The wood of these large trees will be worthless if sawn into plank.
Do as I tell you, Mr. Purcell. I've no mind to argue with you or any man under my command.
Very well, sir. The large trees it is. But I tell you, the plank will be useless. A carpenter knows his business as well as a captain knows his...
Purcell! Huh? You mutinous idiot! You've gone too far. Mr. Byam, take command of the work here. Mr. Purcell, report yourself instantly to Lieutenant Christian for 15 days in irons. Come on, Mr. Nelson.
He calls me a mutinous idiot and puts me in irons for doing my duty. Oh, he has no the last of this. My God, wait till we get to England. I know my rights, I do.
On the 4th of September, with a fine spanking breeze, we weighed anchor and sailed out of Adventure Bay. 7 weeks later, we were among the islands of the South Sea.
Mr. Fryer.
Sir?
Be good enough to step into my cabin.
Yes, sir.
Tomorrow, the day after, we shall drop anchor at Tahiti. I've had Mr. Samuel make an inventory of the stores on hand, which has enabled him to cast up an account of the provisions expended on the voyage so far.
Sir?
I desire to glance over this book, which requires your signature.
Very well, sir. I cannot sign this, sir.
Cannot sign it? What do you mean, sir?
The clerk is mistaken, Mr. Bligh. No such amounts of beef and pork have been issued.
You are wrong. I know what was taken aboard and what remains. Mr. Samuel is right.
I cannot sign, sir.
Why the devil not? All that the clerk has done was by my orders. Sign it instantly. Damn it, I'm not the most patient man in the world.
I cannot sign. Not in conscience, sir.
But you can sign, and what is more, you shall. Mr. Christian, call all hands on deck this instant.
Hands assembled aft, sir.
Now, Mr. Fryer, you know the provisions of the Articles of War for disobeying a commanding officer?
I do, sir.
You are aware that it refers to officers as well as men. Now, sir, sign this book.
Mr. Bligh, the ship's people will bear witness that I sign in obedience to your orders. But please to recollect, sir, that this matter may be reopened later on.
There it is, young man. Tahiti. We made a long passage of it. A long, hard passage. But by God, there is the island at last.
A beautiful island, sir.
Indeed it is. None more so. Captain Cook loved it only next to England. Were I an old man with me work done and no family at home, I should ask nothing better than to pass my days under its palms. And you will find a people as friendly and hospitable as the land they inhabit. Aye, and some of the Indian girls are as beautiful. We come a long way to visit them. Last night I was computing the distance we have run since leaving England. Tomorrow morning, when we drop anchor in Matavai Bay, we shall have sailed more than 27,000 miles.
As we drew nearer to the land with the rising sun behind us, there was not a man on board who didn't gaze ahead with emotions that differed in each case, no doubt, but in which awe and wonder played a part.
Many a time since my voyage with Captain Cook, I've dreamed of revisiting Tahiti without the faintest hope that the dream might come true. Yet, here we are. I can scarcely wait to set foot on shore. I'm sure Mr. Bligh feels the same.
He's certainly different. He was in a rare good humor when he spoke to me this morning.
Old associations by him. You know, I think the happiest times of his life were when he sailed with Captain Cook. He's not been too well treated since, until he was given this commission. The Admiralty never seemed to realize his worth. Now we're safe arrived, I think you'll see a different side of him.
And when shall we sail again?
Oh, time enough to think of that by him. Now, look at him now, talking to Mr. Christian. As you say, he's rarely so affable.
Not a bad voyage, eh, Christian?
Sir?
Only four down with scurvy. Have them right in a week ashore. Ship's as sound as a walnut. Bad anchorage. We'll soon shift out of Matavai Bay, but it's a fine place for revictualling.
Indeed, sir.
And now, midshipmen and gentlemen, the moment you have so eagerly awaited, the opening of Mr. Roger Byam's treasure chest.
No, easy there, Tinkler. Those things cost me £100.
Oh, money well squandered, I hope. What would you say, Stuart?
Patriotically squandered, at all events. He's got a dozen engraved portraits of King George in there.
I had no idea you were such a fanatic, Byam.
Sir Joseph Banks procured those for me. He said they would impress the Indians. And this fishing tackle is that to impress the Indians.
And what about this?
Tinkler, put down that box.
Velvet lined, Stuart. And see what's inside. A bracelet and a necklace. Did Sir Joseph procure those as well, Byam?
No, I bought them in Maiden Lane. Give them back.
Ah, Tinkler, our Byam's a romantic lad. He's been dreaming all the voyage out of some fair barbarian girl who bestowed her favours on him. Now be off with you, Byam. Mustn't keep Captain Bligh waiting.
Ah, Mr. Byam, ready to come ashore with me?
Ready and eager, sir.
We shall probably lie here for several months while Mr. Nelson collects our young breadfruit plants. I'm going to release you from further duties on board so that you may be free to carry out the wishes of my worthy friend Sir Joseph Banks. I have given the matter some thought, and I believe that you will best accomplish your task by living ashore amongst the natives. Everything now depends on your choice of a friend, a Tayo. And let me advise you to go slowly. Persons of consequence in Tahiti as elsewhere do not wear their hearts on their sleeves.
I think I understand, sir.
Yes. Well, by all means, go slowly. Once you've settled on a tayo, you can move your chest and writing materials ashore. After that, I expect to see no more of you, except when you report your progress to me once each week.
Thank you, sir.
You're free to make gifts of your own things to the Indians, but remember, no trading. I've placed all the trading in the hands of Mr. Fryer. Now, Mr. Morrison! Have your boat's crew ready?
All ready, sir.
Very well, Mr. Byam. Let's go ashore. See, we've got quite a reception committee.
Indeed, sir.
Oars!
Up with you, Mr. Byam. Off you go. You've got young legs. Let's see you run up the beach.
All those people. The beach is crowded.
Nothing to be afraid of, young man. If there's a friendlier race in the world than the Tahitians, I've yet to find them. You see that tall man there?
Sir?
Make for him. He's the chief.
Please, please, let me through. Thank you. Good morning.
I am Hitty Hitty. You are midshipman. What name? What name?
Byam.
Byam. Byam. I am Hitty Hitty. 14 years now, I sail Captain Cook.
With Cook? Did you indeed? Mr. Bligh, this man says he sailed with Captain Cook.
I know, lad. I know. What of it? Hello, Hitty Hitty.
Oh, Parai! Welcome!
Hitty Hitty, you've grown little older, my friend. Though you've some gray hairs now.
10 years, eh? Plenty long time. By God, Parai, you get fat. Come ashore. Eat plenty pig. Where Captain Cook? He come Tahiti soon.
My father.
I beg your pardon.
Captain Cook, your father?
Certainly, didn't you know that?
Parai. Byam, me, Fayo, eh?
Ah, that will be excellent. Mr. Byam is the son of a chief in his own land.
Oh.
He will have gifts for you. And in return, I want you to take him to your house, where he will stop.
Good.
His work while we are here is to learn your language, so that British seamen may be able to converse with your people. Do you understand?
Tayo. Tayo, eh?
I couldn't have wished for a better Tayo than Hitty Hitty. The English he had picked up on board the Resolution, Captain Cook's ship, was of great assistance to me in my work, and he was a chief of consequence. He was, in addition, the most charming and tireless of hosts. His house, 60 feet long by 20 wide, with a lofty, newly thatched roof, was to be my dwelling for many months, a period of my life on which I look back with nothing but pleasure. I had not a care in the world save the making of my dictionary, in which I took the keenest interest. I think I may say, in all truth, that I was the first white man to speak fluently the Tahitian tongue, and the first to make a serious attempt to reduce the language to writing. From Hitty Hitty, I learnt the words pertaining to war, religion, navigation, shipbuilding, fishing, agriculture, and other manly pursuits. I obtained vocabularies concerning the pursuits and amusements of women from Hitty Hitty's daughter, Hina, and his niece, My Mitty.
Let me be, Byam. Oh, I can think no more.
Yes, Byam. Take care, or you will crack your head and mine, too, with too much thinking. There is something else for you to think about. You have a friend come to see you.
A friend? From the ship?
I think I'm your friend, Byam, and I most certainly come from the ship.
Christian, what are you doing here?
I've been invited to dinner, haven't I? Hitty Hitty.
Yesterday I dined on the Bounty. I invite Parai to dine with me, but he refuses. Too busy.
Captain Bligh's a very conscientious man, isn't he, Christian?
Oh, he is indeed. But maybe I am not so conscientious. Anyway, I'm here to dine in his place.
We are honored. I go prepare.
Christian, I hope you know what you've undertaken. When I first ate with Hitty Hitty, you can imagine my appetite. Fresh off the ship after so many months at sea.
I know the appetite of a midshipman. I was one myself not so long ago.
They gave us baked fish with cooked plantains and bananas. Then pork, fresh from the oven, with vegetables. You've never seen the like. A great pudding to finish up with in such a sauce. Rich, sweet coconut cream. Well, I forced myself to eat enough for three.
For the honour of England. Oh,
precisely. But Hitty Hitty put me to shame. Long after I was forced to call a halt, he just went on eating.
Well, you sat gazing at this lady. I can hardly blame you.
Your pardon, sir? Ra.
Ra. That also means holy. And woman, My Mitty? What is woman?
Noah.
And that, I'm afraid, also means common.
I see.
Man is descended from the skies, and woman is of the earth. That's what the Tahitians believe. For them to eat together would be sacrilege.
How strange. If anyone ever descended from the skies, it would be that girl.
This is your Tayo, Byam?
This is my good Tayo, My Mitty. His name is Christian.
Christian. Good. Oh, look. Hitty Hitty, come back. You must go eat.
And what will you do?
Me? I go swim. I swim well, do I not, Bayam?
You swim beautifully, my Mitty.
I have always loved swimming. Bayam, is it also forbidden in Tahiti for men and women to swim together?
No, it happens frequently. My Mitty, when Christian has slept off his dinner, we all go swimming together. Would you like that?
I would like it.
Bayam, food is ready.
Hiti is here. We will swim soon. You will not forget.
My God, Bayam.
Hiti, look at my friend.
I told you, Bayam, we have words to describe different kinds of looks,
You did?
There is the word that describes the look that passes between a man and a woman when they love. It cannot be mistaken.
You hear that, Christian? Love at first sight. You lucky devil.
Oh, every sailor must have his sweetheart. And if she'll be mine, I'll stake my life there's not a truer lass in all these islands.
Christian was soon accepted by the household as the avowed lover of Maimiti, and his visits were frequent. Mr. Nelson was established on shore with 8 men to help him gather and pot the breadfruit plants. The Bounty's people who remained on board seemed to have forgotten for the time being their captain's severities and the hardships of our long voyage. Discipline was relaxed. The men were allowed to go on shore, and except for the surgeon, every man of them had his tayo and nearly everyone his Indian lass. Tahiti was a veritable paradise to the seamen. The humblest man in the forecastle might enter any house on shore, assured of a welcome. And as regards the possibilities of dissipation to which seamen are given in every port, the island could only be described as a Mohammedan paradise. One night, when I had been about 6 weeks at the house of Hiti, I was awakened gently by a hand on my shoulder.
Oh, Christian.
Come outside, Bam. I have something to tell you. I must tell you, old Bacchus died last night.
Oh, good God.
Yesterday we purchased about 50 pounds of fish from a canoe, and the surgeon's mess had a string of them fried for dinner. They were poisonous. Haywood, Nelson, and Morrison were close to death for 6 hours, but they're better now. The surgeon died at 8 bells 4 hours ago.
When is he to be buried?
In the morning. Mr. Bligh bade you to be on hand. He was a drunkard, but we shall be the worse off for his death.
Yes. He once told me he could never sleep in a bed. He'd been at sea so long. He dreaded the thought of retirement and years on shore. He's died as he would have wished.
I have been many years at sea, and I can tell you that the well-being of men on shipboard depends on things which seem small. A joke at the right moment or a glass of grog is sometimes more efficacious than the cat of nine tails. With the surgeon gone, life on the Bounty will not be what it was.
I've almost forgotten what it was.
Of course, living here, you're beginning to look like an Indian. Well, be prepared for shocks when you return. Captain Bligh's temper is beginning to reassert itself. Does your tayo ever send gifts of food to the ship?
No. Oh, he has no need when I live here.
Of course. Well, so much the better. As you know, all the Indians feel obliged to send such gifts to their tayos. The captain has announced that all food that comes on board belongs to the ship and is to be dispersed of as he thinks fit. Ooh. If a seaman's tayo has sent him out a fine fat hog, 200 or 300 weight, it comes hard for him to see it go to the ship's stores while he dines on a ration of pork issued by Mr. Samuel.
He makes no exception for the officers?
Not even for Mr. Fryer, though the captain has at the moment 40 hogs of his own. When do you next come on board to report your progress to Mr. Bligh?
On Sunday.
2 days' time. I believe Mr. Haywood should be on duty, if he's recovered from his meal of poisoned fish. You have no great love for Haywood, I believe.
I don't hate him. I think he's something of a bully.
Something, perhaps. When you come on board on Sunday, Bam, keep your eyes about you.
Come on board, Mr. Haywood, sir.
You've a fine bundle there, Ellison. I must have these apples.
Right, sir. You'll find them sweet.
And this fan. Will you give it to me?
I cannot, sir. It comes from a girl. Huh? You've a tale of your own.
He pays no attention these days. What have you there?
Bundle of tapa cloth.
It feels uncommonly like a sucking pig. Shall I call Mr. Samuel? See here. A bargain. The fan's mine, and I say nothing about the pig.
There's your fan, sir.
There's a good lad. Mr. Samuel?
Yes, Mr. Haywood?
Do you want a bit of tender pork? Then go to the forecastle. I suspect that Ellison has a sucking pig wrapped up in a bale of the Indian cloth.
Thank you, Mr. Haywood.
You swine, Haywood.
What?
You've been spying on me, Byam.
And if you weren't such a contemptible sneak, I'd do more than that.
A fine brace of fat hogs, Mr. Christian. Sent you from your lady friend, I'll be bound. Mr. Samuel, come take these hogs for ship's store.
Mr. Bly, I meant these hogs for my own mess.
No. Mr. Samuel, take charge of these Indian curiosities as well. They may be useful for trading on other islands.
One moment, sir. These things were given me for members of my family in England.
What about the pearls, sir?
Pearls? Come, let me see them.
There you are, sir. A fine pair. As big as gooseberries.
Give them to Mr. Samuel. Pearls are highly prized in the Friendly Islands.
Surely, sir, you do not mean to seize these as well. They were given me for my mother.
Deliver them to Mr. Samuel.
I refuse.
Mr. Christian, come back here, sir. Mr. Christian!
It was not hard to imagine the feelings of the Bounty's people at this time. Rationed in the midst of plenty, and treated like smugglers each time they returned from shore. More than 1,000 young breadfruit trees in pots and tubs had been taken on board, and the great cabin resembled a botanical garden. Great quantities of pork had been salted down under the captain's direction, and a large sea store of yams laid in. Only Mr. Bly knew when we would sail, but it was clear that the day of departure could not be far off. Sure enough, the day dawned when Christian came up the beach to call on me, accompanied by my fellow midshipmen, Tinkler and Stewart.
I have news for you, Byam.
Yes?
We are to set sail on Saturday. Mr. Bly bids you come on board on Friday night. Bad news, for me at any rate. I have been very happy here.
And for me.
I'm not sentimental. Toro will soon find another fancy man.
Tinkler's right. When the true seaman leaves one sweetheart, he's already looking forward to the next. But I find it hard to practice what I preach.
Never, I fancy, has one of His Majesty's ships been worked home with less enthusiasm.
Does it seem strange to you, my dear fellow, that we should all feel a little let down after our idyllic life at Tahiti?
Not strange, perhaps, Mr. Nelson, but certainly disturbing.
I'm surprised that the men show as much willingness as they do. My own feelings, as I think of England ahead of us and Tahiti behind, are decidedly mixed ones. Yours must be, too.
I admit that.
Imagine then how the men must feel, who have so little to go home to. What are they to expect at the end of the voyage? Before they've been a week ashore, most of them may be seized by some press gang as recruits for another of His Majesty's ships. Mm. Your health.
And yours.
Who knows what the situation may be when the time the Bounty reaches England? We may be at war with France or Spain or Holland or heaven knows what power. And in that case, alas for any poor seamen arriving in a home port. They won't even be given the chance to spend their back pay. No, a sailor leads a dog's life, Byam, and no mistake.
Do you think war with France is likely?
War with France is always likely. If I were an A.B., I should curse the thought of any war. Think what a paradise Tahiti's been for our men. For once in their lives, they've been treated as human beings. I confess that I was surprised before we left Tahiti that the lot of them didn't take to the hills. I should have done.
Ah, Mr. Christian. There's land on the larboard quarter.
Sir.
10 years ago, I sailed here with Captain Cook.
We can send the boats ashore for wood and water.
I take it this is one of the Friendly Islands, sir?
Captain Cook named them so.
But I've heard that even he found the inhabitants to be far from friendly. With your permission, sir, I think a strong guard should accompany the party sent ashore.
Surely you're not afraid of the beggars, Mr. Christian?
No, sir, but I think we have reason to be cautious in our dealings with them. In my opinion...
Who asked you for your opinion? Damn you, if I haven't got an old woman for my second in command. Well, Mr. Christian, if it'll prevent you from dying of fright, you may have your armed guard. But mark this, on no account are the arms to be used.
Sir.
No mind to have you killing an Indian in a fit of nervousness, bringing the whole swarm down on us. Take Mr. Hayward and Mr. Byam with your party. You may yet turn the cubs into officers. Put your backs into it, lads.
They haven't put out after us, sir. They're still on the beach.
I think we're safe. You acquitted yourselves well, lads. There must have been 200 of them. It's a wonder we escaped without losing a man.
I hardly think that Captain Bligh will consider mere survival to be sufficient, Mr. Christian.
Hold your tongue, Hayward. Mr. Christian did all that was possible. No one could have conducted himself better.
No, Byam, Mr. Hayward is correct. I don't relish the thought of our welcome from Mr. Bligh.
So, Mr. Christian, still alive, I see. And how many men did you lose?
No men, sir. Merely the grapnel of the cutter.
What? You damned incompetent dog.
It was not Mr. Christian's fault, sir.
Listen,
Hundreds of the Indians came down on us while the men were cutting wood. They outnumbered us 50-1. It was only due to Mr. Christian's coolness that we weren't rushed and overwhelmed.
And who asked you to speak, Mr. Byam? Damn you and all other midshipmen. You're all alike. And you, Mr. Christian... You're an incompetent, cowardly rascal, sir. Tell me if you're not. Are you afraid of a crowd of naked savages whilst you have arms in your hands?
Of what service are they, sir, when you forbid their use?
Hold your tongue, Mr. Christian. I'll have no excuses from you, sir. Or from any of you. You're all in collusion against me, officers and men. A rabble of cowards and traitors. So you turn your back on me again, Mr. Christian. Let me tell you, a reckoning will come. I raised you from the mud to make you my lieutenant, and this is your gratitude. And you rate yourself a gentleman? You're a spoiled child, Mr. Christian. A whimpering infant.
I suspect from the captain's mood, Morrison, that it won't be long before there's more work for you. Before this voyage is over, he'll have had you flog every man on board.
Don't joke about it, lad. I hate flogging.
A strange aversion for a boatswain's mate.
I could get no other berth, you know that. And the thought of this voyage fascinated me. To sail to the South Seas. Well, he's killed that for me. The joy of it left me the day he had me flog Churchill for throwing that piece of shark at Samuel.
I remember the look on your face. If you'd shouted aloud, you couldn't have expressed your feelings more clearly. And Bligh saw it too.
Byam, is he insane? I've served under harsh captains, but never one like him.
I don't know. When his rages have passed, I think he has little recollection of them. Have you noticed, all these passions are over matters for which he himself is really to blame? He can't admit a fault in his own conduct. He has to convince himself, through anger, that the blame lies elsewhere.
You may be right. Still, there's one good comes of his fits. They're always followed by some days of calm. He seems to spend himself. Yes, I think we can promise ourselves a quieter day tomorrow.
All the officers are present, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Samuel. Now, gentlemen. Four of the coconuts we took on board at Tahiti are missing. I want to know what has become of them.
There were so many coconuts piled up on deck, sir. How can you be so sure of the loss of so small an amount?
Mr. Fryer, I know to the last ounce how many yams were purchased at Tahiti, and I know the exact number of the coconuts. Would to God that my officers were as conscientious. Now, did you, Mr. Fryer,
see any one of the men helping himself to the coconuts on the quarterdeck?
No, sir.
Mr. Stewart, to you.
No, indeed, sir.
You're lying, you rogues. You're protecting the thieves. Mr. Christian, I wish to know the exact number of coconuts that you purchased at Tahiti for your own use.
I really don't know, sir. But I hope you don't think me so mean as to be guilty of stealing yours.
Yes, you hound, I do think so. You must have stolen some of mine, or you'd be able to give a better account of your own. You damn rascals and thieves, a lot of you. You'll be stealing my yams next. I'll have the men steal for you. And I'll make you suffer. I'll teach you to steal, you dogs. I'll break the spirit of every man of you. You'll wish you'd never seen me before we reach Endeavour Straits. Mr. Samuel.
Yes, sir?
You stop the villain's grog until further orders, and instead of a pound of yams per man, you'll issue half a pound to all the messes. You understand?
Yes, sir.
By God, I'll reduce you to a quarter of a pound if I find anything else missing, and make you crawl on your bellies for that.
What's the time, Byam?
Gone midnight. You could be below, Flintley.
For the matter of that, so should you. It's my bad conscience keeps me awake. Byam, do you know that I'm a double-dyed villain? I stole one of Mr. Bly's missing coconuts.
So it's you we have to thank for our dressing down, you rascal.
Alas, yes. I'm one of the damned rogues and thieves. I could tell you the name of two others, but I forbear. We were thirsty, and there were the coconuts, such a tempting sight. There's nothing more refreshing than coconut water. Really, it's all the fault of old Nelson's breadfruit garden. He keeps it so well watered, a man feels thirsty all the time.
Suppose Bly had asked you, as he asked Christian.
Oh, I'd have denied it, of course. Never had anything to do with his rotten coconuts. But I'm afraid my guilty conscience might have given me away. I was so damn sorry for Christian.
Did Christian know that you'd taken some of the nuts?
Not some, only one. Of course he did. In fact, he saw me do it and looked the other way, as any decent officer was bound to do. It wasn't as though we were endangering the safety of the vessel. Four coconuts out of how many thousand? Well, I can sleep over my sins. Perhaps they won't seem so black tomorrow.
You're like the ship's cat, Tinkler. You can curl up anywhere.
Yeah, the deck makes the most comfortable bed on a hot night like this. No need to go below, you see. Night, Byam.
Night, Tinkler.
Byam.
Christian. How are you?
Did you know that he'd invited me to sup with him? Why? Can you tell me that? After spitting on me, wiping his feet on me, he sent Samuel to ask me to eat at his table.
You didn't go?
After what had happened? God in heaven, no.
Well, perhaps you should have done. Maybe he was trying to make amends.
You believe that no more than I do. We're in his power. Officers and men alike, he considers us so many dogs to be kicked or fondled according to his whim. And there can be no relief. None. Not till we reach England. God knows when that will be. Byam, there's something I wish you would do for me.
What is it?
The chances are there'll be no occasion, but on a long voyage like this, one never knows what may happen. If, for any reason, I should fail to reach home, I'd like you to see my people in Cumberland. Would that be too much trouble for you?
Not at all.
During the last conversation I had with my father, just before I joined the ship, he asked that I make such an arrangement with someone aboard the Bounty. In case anything should happen, he said that it would be a comfort to him to talk with one of my friends. I promised, and I've let half the voyage pass without fulfilling it. I feel better now that I've spoken.
You can count on me.
Good. Well, that's settled then.
Well, Mr. Christian, you're up late.
Yes, sir.
You, Mr. Byam, don't you sleep?
It's very warm below, sir.
I'd noticed it. A true sailor can sleep in an oven if the case requires, on a cake of ice. Hello, Mr. Christian. They want you falling asleep on watch. Good night, Mr. Byam.
My God, Byam, will it never end? Can a captain talk to his officer like that? You heard what he called me yesterday? A whimpering infant. That's what he'll make of me.
He can't do that. You did the right thing yesterday. He just walked away and let him rave.
I don't think I can do that any longer, Byam. I'm not that patient. I'm no more patient than he is, I think. No, I must do something.
I'll take a turn forward, I think. It may ease my mind. Good night, Van.
Oh, go below, Balm, and show that you're a true sailor. Damn you and Christian and your gabble. I was just getting drowsy when he came along.
Did you hear what he said?
About notifying his father in case of anything happening. Yes, I couldn't help eavesdropping. My father made no such request of me, which only goes to show that he has no hope of my not coming back. The voice of the angels, Byam. Come, my lord, let me escort you to your hammock.
Shortly after daybreak, I was awakened by someone shaking me roughly by the shoulder, and at the same time I was aware of loud voices, Mr. Bly's among them, and the heavy trampling of feet on deck. Churchill, the master-at-arms, stood by my hammock with a pistol in his hand, and I saw Thompson, one of the seamen, holding a musket with the bayonet fixed, stationed by the arms chest.
What is it, Churchill? What's happening?
We'll find out soon enough, Mr. Byam.
We're with you, Churchill. Give us arms.
Give them a musket each, Thompson.
Right.
And on deck with a pair of you.
Have we been attacked, Churchill?
Put on your clothes and lose no time about it, Mr. Byam. You too, Mr. Stewart. We have taken the ship and Captain Bligh is a prisoner.
They've mutinied, Byam. Good God, Churchill, are you mad? Have you any conception of what you're doing?
We know very well what we're doing. Bligh has brought all this on himself. And now, by God, we'll make him suffer.
Yeah, we're going to shoot the dog. Seize him up, Churchill. They're not to be trusted.
Hold your tongue and mind the arms chest. Come, Mr. Byam, hurry into your clothes. Quintal.
Aye.
Stand fast by the door there. No one's to come forward without my orders, understand?
Aye, aye.
Mr. Churchill. Mr.
Go
Churchill.
Go back, Samuel, or I'll run you through the guts.
Mr. Churchill, sir, please allow me to speak to you.
Run him back. Give him a prod in the backside, Quintal.
It's useless, Byam. There's nothing to be done.
All right, you two. Up the ladder way. Keep the other midshipmen in the berth, Thompson.
Leave him to me. I'll mind
what
them.
What about Christian? He's our only hope.
Don't you worry. You'll see Christian soon enough. Come on now. On deck with you.
This is treason, you fool!
There's Mr. Christian for you. Guarding Captain Bligh, that's where he is. Now, you two, stand by here. We mean no harm to either of you, unless you take part against us.
Byam! Christian, the ringleader. Then there's no hope.
You're committing treason, let me remind you.
Will you hold your tongue, sir, or shall I force you to hold it? I'm master of this ship now, and by God, I'll stand no more of your abuse.
Master of my ship, you mutinous dog. I'll see you hung. I'll have you flogged to ribbons.
Silence, sir! Hold your tongue, or you are dead this instant.
Mister, allow me to speak. Allow me to speak. Think what you do. Release me, lay aside your arms. Let us be friends again. And I give you my word that nothing more shall be said of this matter.
Your word is of no value, sir. Had you been a man of honor, things would never have come to this pass.
What do you mean to do with me?
Shoot you, you bloody rogue.
Shooting's still good for him. Seize him up by the gratings, Mr. Christian. Give us a chance at him with a cat.
Yes, seize him up. Give him a piece of his own poison.
Play the eyes off him. Silence!
We'll give you justice, sir, which is more than you've ever given us. We'll take you in irons to England.
To England? Never. We won't have it, Mr. Christian.
And me guard him, Mr. Christian. I'll watch him like a cat. Oh, you rogue. You old villain. You'd flog us, would you? You'd stop our grog, would you? You'd make us eat grass, would you?
Give me that job in the guts.
You're Mr. Samuel, a pair of swindlers. That's what you are. Cheating us out of our food. You made a fortune between you. You old thief. You should be a bumboat man. I'll let you make your fortune in no time.
That will do. Be silent there. Now, McCoy, Smith, Millward, clear the cutter.
Aye, aye, sir.
Mr. Churchill.
Aye, aye, sir.
Fetch up Mr. Fryer and Mr. Purcell.
Sir.
Beckett.
Yes, sir.
You and Sumner and Martin stand guard over Mr. Bligh.
We'll mind him, sir. I'll lead him.
What's your plan, Mr. Christian? We've a right to know.
Mind what you're about, Sumner. I'm master of the ship. Lively, men, with the cutter. Byam, this is my affair. Not a man shall be hurt, but if any take part against us, it will be at the peril of the entire ship's company. Act as you think best.
What do you mean to do?
I would have carried Bligh to England as a prisoner. That's impossible. The men won't have it. He shall have the cutter to go where he chooses. Mr. Fryer, Haywood, and Samuel shall go with him.
And you will sail to England without them?
To England?
To the yardarm, you mean? No, Byam. After this, we can none of us set foot in England again.
What do they mean to do with us?
We'll find out soon enough. Here's Mr. Fry and Mr. Purcell, sir.
In God's name, Mr. Christian, what is it you do? Do you realize this means the ruin of everything? Give up this madness, and I promise we shall all make your interests our own. Only let us reach England.
It's too late, Mr. Fryer. I have been in hell for weeks past, and I mean to stand it no longer.
Your difficulties with Captain Bligh give you no right to bring ruin upon the rest of us.
Hold your tongue, sir. Mr. Purcell, have your men fetch up the thwarts, knees, and gearbolts for the large cutter.
Aye, sir.
Churchill, let the carpenter go below to see to this. Send a guard with him.
Do you mean to set us adrift?
We are no more than 9 leagues from the land here. Mr. Bligh will have no difficulty in making it.
I will stay with the ship.
No, sir, you will go with Captain Bligh. Millward, take Mr. Fryer to the cabin while he collects his clothes.
Aye, aye, sir.
He's to be kept there until I send word.
Here's the carpenter with the gear for the cutter, sir.
Right, have the carpenter's mates begin fitting her out. Mr. Purcell, you will stay here with Mr. Byam. Lively, lads, with the cutter.
Mr. Byam, I know that you've had no hand in this business, but you are, or have been, a friend to Mr. Christian. Oh, beg him to give Captain Bligh the launch. The cutter is rotten and will never swim to land.
Right, it's riddled with holes. Very well, Mr. Purcell. Come with me and we'll speak to Mr. Christian.
He would not care to grant any request of mine. No, it must come from you. If the cutter is hoisted out, it'll be almost certain death for Captain Bligh and all who are permitted to go with him.
Very well, Mr. Byam. He shall have the launch. Tell the carpenter to have his men fit her. Leave off with the cutter, my lads. Clear the launch.
The launch, Mr. Christian? Oh, you give him that and the old fox will get home in her.
Mr. Churchill, I say he shall have the launch.
Oh, let him be, lads. Launch or cutter as long as we're rid of the swine.
Bring the rest of them on deck, Churchill.
Samuel's here already, sir. Hey, Samuel, you bloody shark. You remember the 3 dozen lashes you got me? See what your precious captain can do for you now.
What are your orders, Captain Bligh?
He gives no more orders, Mr. Samuel.
Well, Byam, I'm afraid that we're even farther from home than we thought. Do you know what they plan to do with us?
Set us adrift in the launch, Mr. Nelson.
The nearest island is Tofoa. I suppose that Captain Bligh will take us there. I don't much relish the prospect of meeting any more friendly islanders. Their friendliness is of a kind that we can well dispense with.
Mr. Nelson, we know whom we have to thank for this.
Yes, Mr. Purcell, our unlucky stars.
No, sir. We have Captain Bligh to thank for it, and him alone. He's brought it upon us all by his damnable behavior.
If those are your feelings, you might be permitted to stay with the ship, if you choose.
Stop aboard. With rogues and pirates? Oh, never, sir. Oh, I shall follow my commander.
Mr. Christian says... What are you about there, Purcell? Damn your blood, you'd steal our tools, would you?
Your tools, you scoundrel? They're mine, and they go where I go.
You shan't take a nail from the ship if I have my way. Come on deck with you. Mr. Christian, old Purcell here wants to make off with a tool chest. We must keep it on board.
I've half a mind to keep him here himself. We need his skill.
You can't trust him, sir.
Keep the carpenter's mates, Mr. Christian. They're the men
make
for us.
Make him go in the boat.
Make me go, you pirates. I'd like to see the man who will stop me. Mark my words, you rogues. We'll bring every man of you to justice. Aye, we'll build a vessel to carry us home.
So he will, Mr. Christian, if we give him tools. The old fox could build a ship with a clasp knife.
Look out the tool chest, Millward. Let him have a saw, a hammer, a bag of nails. Nothing more.
So you're an infernal idiot.
Quiet there! Where's Mr. Morrison?
Yeah.
Now the launch has been cleared. Swing her out.
Yeah.
Churchill, some men to assist the boatswain's mate.
Our men, sir?
And have them lay down their arms. No. Tell off 15 men of Captain Bligh's party. You can begin with Mr. Byam there.
What's all the mainsail there? Leg of sheets, sun tacks.
All clear, Morrison.
Clew garnets. Up with the clues. Now, swing her out. Far away, handsomely.
Now, Mr. Samuel, Into the boat with you. Mr. Hayward.
Mr. Christian, what have I ever done that you should treat me so? In God's name, permit me to stay with the ship.
We can dispense with your services here. Into the boat. Now, Mr. Purcell.
You have no need to urge me, Mr. Christian. I'd rather die than stay.
So be it. Hand him down his tools, Millward.
Aye, aye, sir.
Bring Mr. Bligh to the gangway. Free his hands. Now, Mr. Bligh, there is your boat. And you are fortunate to have the launch and not the cutter. Go into her at once, sir.
Mr. Christian, the last time I beg you to reflect. I'll pawn my honor. I pledge my word never to think of this again if you will desist. Consider my wife and family.
No, Mr. Bligh, you should have thought of your family long before this. And we well know what your honor is worth. Go into the boat, sir.
Let me help you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Sam.
You have your compass, sir. This book of nautical tables is sufficient for every purpose. And the sextant is my own. You know it to be a good one. They will be handed down to you.
I know you to be a scoundrel, but I'll have vengeance. Mind that, you ungrateful villain. I'll see you swinging in a yardarm before 2 years have passed. And every traitor with you.
Mr. Nelson, you and Mr. Byam may stay with the ship if you choose.
I have sympathy with the wrongs you have suffered, Mr. Christian, but none whatever with this action to redress them.
And when have I asked you for sympathy, sir? Mr. Byam, what is your decision?
I shall go with Captain Bligh.
Then make haste, both of you.
Have we permission to fetch our clothes?
Yes, but look sharp about it.
Byam, what are you doing here?
I've come to collect my clothes. Mr. Christian gave permission.
Well, then be quick about it. Morrison's in the next berth collecting his stuff. Bring him out with you.
Morrison? Morrison?
Ah, Byam. All ready to go.
Keep your voice down. Look in the corner of the berth.
War clubs. Where did you get them?
They were given to me in Tahiti. No use in pitched fight. But maybe if Thompson comes in to get us, we can club him and take the arms chest.
My God, lad. It's a chance.
Thompson! Byam down there.
He's getting his clothes, sir. I'll have him up at once.
We're in luck, Morrison. He's coming in for us.
Out of there, Byam, and hurry.
I'm coming.
Hey, Thompson, what's going on there?
What is it?
Two men.
Tell him to get a move on, Thompson.
Burkett and McCoy. Damn them, why don't they go? We've no chance against the three of them.
Byam, I'll be there later. You'll be left behind.
For God's sake, hasten, Byam. Oh, too late, Byam. Put the clubs aside. We must run on deck.
Yes, run.
You're too late, Byam. You can't go.
Can't go? By God, I will.
I can take no more of you, lads. I'll do you justice if ever we reach England.
God, see if you can live on half a pound of yams a day, you villain.
In God's name, Mr. Christian, give us arms and ammunition. Think where we go. Let us have a chance to defend our lives.
Arms be damned.
You don't need them.
Oh, Bligh loves the savages. You take care of them.
Use your rattan on them, bosun.
For God's sake, Christian, let Mr. Bligh have some muskets and ammunition.
No, they shall have no firearms.
They give them some cutlasses at least, Mr. Christian. Do you wish them to be murdered the moment they set foot on shore? Think of our experience at Namuka.
Very well. Churchill, hand them down some cutlasses.
Here, carpenter, catch.
You cowards, four cutlasses, will you give us nothing but these?
You'll get a belly full of lead in a minute.
God's name, Mr. Bligh, let us cast off before they murder us. I'm sure that man Burkett needs to shoot.
Very well, Mr. Fryer. Cast off there.
Cast off it is, sir.
How many men are there in that launch, Byam?
There are 19.
12 would make a good load, to say nothing of the food and water and all their gear. Thank God we were too late to go with her. That delay over those clubs of yours may have saved our lives.
Do you mean that, Morrison?
Oh, no, I don't. I would willingly have taken my chance in her, but it's a slim chance indeed. I'll never see England again.
Tinkler, Nelson, Fryer, Purcell, Samuel, Hayward. They were all as good as dead, more than 1,000 miles from any port where they might expect help. Granted that some might escape death at the hands of the Indians, what chance had so tiny a boat, so appallingly loaded, to reach any civilized port? The day following the mutiny, to my amazement, Christian asked me to sup with him.
Sit you down, Van. I hardly expect you to be glad of my society, but there are matters we must discuss.
There can hardly be cause for discussion. Why should 16 armed men need to parley with 9 who have no weapons?
Our numbers matter very little now, Byam. More men went in the launch than belonged to either of our 2 parties left on board. And it seems my 15 men will not be mine much longer.
What do you mean?
I told you yesterday we should none of us set foot in England again. When I seized the ship, my only thought was that I would carry Bligh home in irons. The men wouldn't have it. You saw that for yourself. So we are branded as mutineers. Not only that, but pirates as well, since we've run away with one of His Majesty's armed vessels. Well, this is the greatest ocean in the world, set with innumerable islands. On one of them, we shall settle and destroy the ship. There is no other way.
Not even for those of us who had no hand in the mutiny.
But I take it your wish would be to return to Tahiti.
It would.
I should be foolish to grant it. Sooner or later, an English ship will put in, and you will feel bound to tell them of the mutiny. Then they will sail in pursuit of me.
But need they find you? As you said, the Pacific is wide.
Let us hope it is wide enough. Byam, you shall have your wish. You and your friends, Stuart, Morrison, all of you who would have gone in the launch had there been room, you may return to Tahiti.
Why have you decided this?
Because my men are besotted with Tahiti. They too wish to return there.
Then you'll come with us.
I shall take you there, of course. I shall not remain. 8 of my party are in favor of my original plan. When I leave Tahiti, they will sail with me. And you shall see us no more, I promise you that. As for the others, since they refuse to follow me, I am forced to wash my hands of them.
Which are they?
Burkitt, Millward, young Tom Ellison. There are 8 in all. Even Churchill wishes to remain in Tahiti. I would have thought he had more sense. So, Byam, you may return to your friends and break the good news to them.
In our situation, there can be no good news. Oh, in God's name, Christian, why have you done this? Why have you brought ruin on us all?
Yes. You are right, Byam. It is ruin. And for me, more than anyone. I shall never know peace again, never until my last day. And all for yielding to a moment's impulse.
An impulse? But wasn't it planned?
Good God, Byam. 10 minutes before Bligh was seized, I'd no more thought of mutiny than you yourself. Let me tell you. Do you remember the talk we had on deck the night before?
Perfectly.
I asked that in case anything happened to me during the voyage, you would explain to my people when you reached England. My reason was that I planned to leave the ship before the morning watch.
Leave the ship? But how?
On a raft. I had spoken to no one except one of the quartermasters, John Norton. I knew I could trust him. He was a loyal man.
He was loyal to Bligh, too. He went in the launch.
Exactly. Norton managed to make, secretly, a tiny raft upon which I hoped to reach the nearest of the Friendly Islands. With the sea as calm as it was, I had every reason to think that I could make the land.
You really meant to cut yourself off for all time from home and friends?
Yes. I was in hell, Byam. I'd suffered from Bligh's tyranny to the limit of my endurance. When he accused me that same afternoon with stealing his coconuts, I felt that I could bear no more.
I know you were sorely tried, but we were all in the same sorry situation with you.
I didn't think of that. I thought only of the shame of the accusation, of the contemptible, sordid meanness of the man who could bring such a charge against his officers. I knew that I could not and would not endure another year of torment. But luck was against me. Most of the ship's company were on deck, and becalmed as we were, it would have been impossible to slip away unseen. Then, at 4 o'clock, I took over as officer of the watch. I had easy access to weapons. My watch was full of men like Burkitt, men who'd been punished by Bligh too often and hated him. Suddenly, the solution seemed obvious. Seize the ship.
What chance do you think Bligh has of reaching England?
Little enough. Timor is the nearest place where they could expect help, 1,200 leagues away. I've told you before, Bligh is a magnificent seaman. If anybody could make that voyage, he could. But in an open boat laden with 19 men. And I had to let them go. Men like Fryer and Purcell, I could not let stay aboard. They'd be bound to try and retake the ship. Well, enough of this. Enough of this.
19 men cast adrift in an open boat. 9 more doomed to spend the rest of their days on some undiscovered island. Another 8 remaining on Tahiti, where an English ship must surely call one day and take them home to be hanged. Out of the whole ship's company, only 7 of us, those who had had no hand in the mutiny, and would likewise return to Tahiti to await the first English ship, had come out of the voyage of the Bounty scot-free. And even our fate could hardly be termed enviable. I doubt whether a ship has ever sailed from England whose company, during the course of her voyage, were to be so widely scattered over the face of the earth, and whose individual members were to meet ends so strange, and in many cases, so tragic.
In Mutiny on the Bounty, which was dramatized for radio by Robert Cushman, from the novel by Charles Nordhoff and James Norman Hall, Captain Bligh was played by Geoffrey Matthews, Mr. Fletcher Christian by Martin Jarvis, and Mr. Roger Byam by Geoffrey Beavers. Sir Joseph Banks, William Edel, Mr. Fryer, Wilfred Carter, Old Backus, Garrett Green, Ellison, Bill Lyons, Mr. Stewart, Gareth Johnson, Churchill, Sean Arnold, Mr. Nelson, Alexander John, Mr. Purcell, Nigel Lambert, Mimiti, Sandra Clark, Morrison, Richard Hampton, Mr. Samuel, John Brining, and Captain Courtney, John Sampson. Other parts were played by members of the cast. The producer was Roger Pine.